Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
You're listening to the Sherlock's Podcast, your guide to a more stylish life.
Hello, I'm Georgie Courage-Cole, Sherlock's founder and CEO, and welcome to today's In Conversation With podcast. Today, I always say I'm thrilled, but I'm really thrilled to be joined by Scott Wimsett. Scott, well, he's many things, but first and foremost, a presenter, social media director, and sustainability expert, and also a husband and a father. he started leading content agency Bespoke Banter in 2006.
Yeah.
And he and his team work with celebrities and brands to create content for a range of markets. Today, he joins me to talk about his career, his life, parenting in a same-sex relationship, mm-hmm. the lessons he's learned along the way, a bit about sustainability and why it's so important, and lots more. Welcome. How lovely to have you.
I'm thrilled to be here, Georgie. What a thrill.
Oh, well, we met through both of our partnerships with Ascot
Race
Lovely
Ascot, course. Yeah.
And I feel like we've sat on several occasions and had these conversations.
We had a quick deep dive together, didn't we? Sort of, you know, when you sort of takes one to know one type thing, we were like, let's do this.
And I think there were a couple of tears and I was like, right, you need to come and share this story, your amazing story, with our listeners. So thank you. And let's start with your background. Who are you? Where did you grow up? What was your childhood like?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it feels like so many other lifetimes ago, but I grew up in a very small seaside town called Broadstairs, which is charming, very, very sweet little seaside town. And fortunately for me, into a very, and I don't use that word often and not lightly, but a very eccentric family in the way of colourful people, big family. My grandmother was a big antique dealer, you know, her friend was Hattie Jakes from the Carry On movies. You know, the guys on the beach doing the Punch and Judy were always at her house having drinks parties. Like, she was that girl.
Wow.
And, you know, and she would be the one that you'd go to with any kind of family drama or a bit of a powwow and have a gin and tonic and a silk cut in the kitchen type thing, aged 13. You know, it was that kind of thing. Oh, and then mummy would just host, like, always remember the house just being full of people. So often on a Sunday, you would have between 15 to 20 people for lunch every single Sunday. And I think growing up with that and then sort of coming out and, you know, just being around these slight bombastic, colourful people after lunch, we'd all be full of red wine and go and dance to the Stones in my dad's study. And, you know, that wasn't, I did my father's eulogy recently and that was not a one-off. It was every single Sunday. So there was a big appetite for fun. And then there was our school in the middle of all of it. But
damn it, damn school. What was your father like?
Navy, on the outs, sort of front, very, very strict, but actually absolute hoot and given all the right ingredients, like a bit naughty and fun. Yeah, definitely.
Do you have siblings?
Yes.
And Navy, your father, this sort of more is more, the doors open, childhood, you as a gay man, when did you know you were a gay man? How did your father, your parents take that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it was a surprise to anyone, let's put it that way, because I think I was sort of doing Russian ballet and tap and sort of tennis classes while my brother was doing rugby and swimming and all the rest of it. I think, God, when did I come out? It was probably when I was at boarding school in Cambridge, when it all kind of landed. And I remember wanting to tell my grandmother more than anybody else. It was sort of felt like I needed to speak to her first. And I remember getting back, cycling to her house, going around the back of the house because I couldn't get any answer and saw her sunbathing with her best mate who was gay. And they were sort of sunbathing on the
lounges. So you were excited to tell her.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, George is here. And anyway, she sort of held the meeting in the kitchen and I couldn't really get the words out. And I was like, well, the thing is, I'm what I'd like to say is I think, and she went, you're gay. And I went, Yes, she went, oh, for Christ's sake, Scott, she said, we've known for years. So that was it. And it was very easy.
Yeah, that's amazing. God, and I'm sure so many people didn't have that response.
I know.
That was lucky. Mean, you're obviously still only 32.
Of course.
But yes. How old were you when you sat down with your granny and had that conversation?
Yeah, 18.
18.
Yeah.
And what was school like? You're obviously at the end of your school career.
Yeah.
How did it feel at school? Was that a difficult time?
No, I mean, I was head boy, and I think that whole kind of showy part of sort of public speaking, when all of that nonsense that comes with being head boy, I kind of loved it. And I kind of acquired a new group of pals by that kind of get them all into dinner early, or I can't remember what it was, this kind of power you have as head boy. But I
loved that you were head boy.
I mean, I know. I was very academic, and then I went very bonkers in the 90s.
Right, okay,
so it was a little bit of the two. I kind of was really studious, and then I sort of discovered the parties, and I was like, okay, see you later.
So you left school.
Yes.
And what happened next?
Came to London, went to university, did drama at Brunel. So it was a sort of, you know, drama course type thing. Loved that. Left, moved to Hong Kong. My uncle was in the government in Hong Kong and sort of said, why don't you come out here and just give this a go? My brother was already living there.
Oh, really?
And my uncle was a sort of really charismatic older gentleman. He's still alive. He's still with us. He was director of Marines, so he was head of Hong Kong Harbour. So it was that expat kind of life where they kind of would just seem to only go to cocktail parties. That's all they seemed to do, the three a night, and they did all the business.
I mean, there were a lot. Actually, my father lived in Hong Kong.
Right, so you know exactly what
I spent a lot of time. I remember turning up for Christmas holidays once and my stepmother saying, we seem to have something every single night. And actually, the best thing about it was I was sort of 13 and there would be 16-year-olds snogging and getting pissed and smoking, who I thought was so cool. And then there'd be 25-year-olds, and then my parents, who must have been in their 40s, and then there'd be 70-year-olds, and everyone was just having the most fabulous time together.
Yeah, I know.
And actually, my father, had he lived in England, stayed in England, he'd be a very different person, but it
was of a time, wasn't it?
Generations.
It was all the kind of Hong Kong club and the ABC and the boat club. And it was
amazingly he actually got to work, but you know, the stamina.
The stamina.
It's huge.
Yeah. I mean, my uncle would have his driver sort of take him to like three parties of an evening, and he would go in the front door to the first one, the side door on the middle one, and then leave out the back door on the last one, home for dinner for eight, having done three parties. And I was like, wow.
Yeah, I'm not so good at leaving. So, yeah,
life like lessons.
So Hong Kong, you were there.
Hong Kong, and then I modelled in Hong Kong. So my brother was living there. He got me an introduction because I was working in a bar called The Go Down, which was in Central, and then I got scouted by this agency. And that changed quite a lot of my time there, actually, because then I could get my own flat in Happy Valley, and I could, just sort of feel like I was doing something creative, and it was for me, and I was Guilo, and I had long blonde hair, and I was getting jobs, and I was like, this is great. And then I, you know, had sort of fallen in love with this guy before I left. And so as much as I did 2.5 years there, I had to come back and just see what happened with this sort of relationship. And I did come back, and it was joyful.
But he wasn't the one.
He wasn't the one, but he was amazing, and it was all part of the journey.
And so you came back here. Did you model here? What happened after
him? It was all very odd. I mean, boyfriend at the time, you'll laugh at this, because he was living in a squat in Brixton. And my parents were very confused by my life choice when I was sort of with my gorgeous boyfriend and sort of spending my time visiting him in his squat in Brixton. And they were like, you've just been in Hong Kong having this sort of she time, and now you're doing. I was like, yeah, but I'm in love. And I was genuinely in love. But then I got a job in a... The modelling was harder here. I mean, I think because I wasn't sort of 6 foot whatever, and I was getting more kind of commercial stuff that wasn't really what I wanted to do.
And what are we 90s here?
Yeah. Early 90s. So, so 94, 95, something like that.
Yeah.
And then I got a job in a PR agency, SPA Way, for Sarah Mason Pearson. And she was quite something, and I absolutely adored her. And and then from there I went to Modus Publicity and sort of did various different sort of fashion PR gigs and loved it to a point. And then I realised that actually I was great at the creative, but I was useless with other people's budgets. So I knew that the going senior role within sort of PR wasn't my thing.
Right. And so what did you do with that realization?
This is the start of the business, really.
This is the start of Bespoke Banter.
Yeah.
So let's go back a bit then before we get to Bespoke Banter. So you're with your boyfriend in the
squat in Brixton.
You were in the squat in Brixton. He wasn't the one. Talk to me about Paul O'Grady. I mean, you and I chatted. He was a very significant part of your life.
Yeah, huge part of my life. Still is in many ways. I met Paul when it was, shows how long ago it was. It was Attitude Magazine's launch party. So, I mean, I think they've had their 20th anniversary or something not too long ago. So it was a long time ago. And we met and had a real laugh. I didn't think anything of it. I sort of gave him my number at the end of the evening. And then it was about 3 months later, I might have told you this, and I was at a Madonna concert in Brixton. And my phone just kept on ringing nonstop. And so I eventually left the concert and went outside and was like, hello. And is that, all right, I've just found your number in a sock. And I'm in New York with Cilla. And I was like, oh, gosh, hello. And he said, well, look, I'm back next week. Why don't you come down to the house and I'll send you a driver? And I was like, okay, fine. I phoned my mom and said, do you think I should? And she was like, yeah, go for it. And that just sort of started this very lovely relationship. So we sort of started dating and you'd never
what
put
was
us
your
together.
Age gap?
Quite big. I think I put my parents through all sorts of traumas when they kind of go see this Liverpudlian drag queen doing blankety blank. And I'm like, oh, that's my girlfriend, my boyfriend.
Oh, God, I miss blankety blank.
Oh, it was good, wasn't it?
I mean, I miss Saturday
night.
Bit of
Lily in her little
simple
mini skirt. Sort
is
of
it Friday or Saturday? I can't
Saturday
remember.
Night, yeah.
Saturday. I miss the simplicity of
Blind Date and all those
Baywatch
guys.
Baywatch, Blind Date, Gladiators and Blankety Blank. That's all you need.
Beverly Hills 90210.
God, it made us so happy, didn't it?
Blissful.
I mean, none of this nonsense. Shall we? Which streaming service shall we look at now? God. So started a wonderful relationship.
It was fun. And, you know, I was young. I mean, Georgie, I was sort of suddenly going for dinners with Joan Collins and, you know, hanging out with Cilla. I mean, these sort of iconic British stars that were just Paul's friends. And it
and
was
he
just
really
a bit of a
was a star. I feel like some of our young listeners might not.
No, exactly.
Remember
yeah.
or know what a star he was. What yeah. a star Lily was.
Yeah. Lily was major, wasn't she?
Huge.
But it was just, that was the
and
time
was
when it was all landing for him. You know, yeah. he was sort of, he suddenly did The Big Breakfast after Paulie Yates, and then he ended up doing Blankety Blank, and then, it, you know, then he had his own shows, and then it kind of really took off, and that was the time we were together. So it was just fascinating to watch it. You know, he'd come home from the studio still dressed as Lily with a can of cider and sort of march around the kitchen with all the dogs running behind him on a trumpet. And oh I was God. Like, you are such fun. And, you know, there's something very interesting about how you become attracted to people who are really bloody funny. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very kind of, yeah, it's a very attractive quality in yeah. people. And something.
And did he have that energy off screen that he had?
Without even knowing it, he was funny all the time to me. I laughed all the time. I never stopped laughing all. And I, you know, and then, you know, for whatever reasons, we didn't stay together, but it was a long stint and we stayed really good friends. And he, before he passed, he was very close to my son, very close to my husband. Yeah, big part of my life. So sadly, greatly missed. But I feel
sorry.
He's there and I feel like it's a, he'd hate this, but I feel like he's a guardian angel. I can hear his voice saying,
God,
go for it or
you.
Don't do that. You know, he taught me a lot. Yeah.
Wow. So you and him went your separate ways. And what did you, work-wise, this had been running alongside the world of PR, had it?
Yes, and sporadic bits of acting and bits of modelling. And, you know, I was just sort of freelancing and just
you were living your
to be
best life.
I was having
with
an
Paul.
Absolute riot. Yeah.
Having dinner with Joan Collins.
Yeah.
I mean, oh my God, I'm so envious. Tell us more about what life was like as a gay man living his best life in London.
90s and early 2000s, it was a lot of fun. I don't know if it's quite as much fun coming onto the gay scene now in London. I'm not sure I would choose London. I'd probably go to Cape Town or something, Berlin or something a bit more fun. But in those days, you know, it was everything. I just said yes to a lot of things. And that way of growing up and being from a quiet seaside town, I think I did tell myself, let's just start doing a mantra of yes rather than no. And so that can get you into all sorts of pickles, but it can also give you life experiences that you will hold forever. And I'm very much about trying things out for yourself and then working out whether it fits for you. I don't really come from any place of judgment or, judge anybody by how they live their lives within reason. That's my approach. It's just trying as many things as you can, and then you have an opinion on it.
And you seem to have this amazing network of talented, creative friends. You've said you're great friends with Alice Templey, for example. I mean, clearly you're really loved by people.
Well, that came with work, I suppose.
Yeah, how does that just happen? I mean, you're pretty fabulous. So does it just... Just fabulous meet fabulous and wonderful things happen.
You're pretty fabulous, Angela. Look at Sheer Lux. I mean, you know how it works. It's just sort of, I had an idea.
But did you work hard too? Were you kind to people? Were you...
Exactly. What's all of those qualities that sort of hold you in good stead and build a brand, I guess. I mean, I had an idea early 2000s that there might be something behind filming events or talent interviews for brands. Now, this was before... We were into social media. It was before people really knew about content as such. But I had a good old go at PR. I'd also been doing a sort of sporadic acting gigs here and a bit of presenting. And I kind of wanted to marry everything together and started to use my network of PR agencies that I'd sort of, been freelancing for many, many years. And I remember going to Modus Publicity and sort of, the communication store in those days and sort of saying, well, you've got this event coming out, so why don't we film it for you? And then when I, what would we do with that? I was like, I don't know, I could syndicate it for
There's
you.
There's a single social coming and it's going to be huge.
It's huge, you're going to love it. And they were really confused. I was like, well, at the very least, we could put it on your website. But in those days, the Vogue Online had just started and Dolly Jones was sort of like, well, I'll take that. If there's a shop opening on Bond Street or... Kate Moss doing a new lipstick or whatever. So it just started to do its thing. And I think we were the first agency in London to create bespoke content for fashion and beauty brands. And I think what was the ingredient is that not one size fitted all, that actually a Rimmel would be very different to an Yves Saint Laurent or whatever. And from a PR perspective, obviously, I kind of understood those subtle differences in regards to how we'd shoot it, the kind of crew, the cameras, the lenses, the lighting, the look and feel of that brand.
Yeah.
And then with time, there was that sort of trust that came in. And because I would get frustrated if they didn't sort of put the content anywhere, I'd start to syndicate it for them. So if it was a biggie, we could do it via Reuters in those days to sort of showbiz desks, and I could gauge what kind of traffic it was getting and their start if the agency.
Amazing. And that was Bespoke Banter.
That's Bespoke Banter.
You launched in 2006.
Yeah.
And that was quite a while ago. And today...
Still going, yeah. It's so different to what it was. I mean, businesses sort of go in different shapes and sizes over their journey. I think what happened to us, I was old school, so I built the business in that way with a business partner at the time, that if I was going to create an infrastructure and an arm to say an Estee Lauder, a Coty, a L'Oreal or whatever, they didn't have any of their in-house crew in those days. We'd got all of that business. So I felt that it was important to provide this very big team, which made us quite expensive because there were lots of mouths to feed.
Yeah.
And then obviously content took off in such a way that people needed more and more and more content, and we became quite an expensive option. So we had to sort of shrink our business offering because we had 25 in London and 2 in New York, and it was hefty every month, and offices and all the rest of it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but now we're a very different business model. We sort of crew up to 30 crew for like a big shoot, but the sort of day-to-day is 4 staff.
People always say, how many people do you employ? And I'm like, that's not the measure of success, as in the measure is making the money. And actually, a great agency can have a very tight...
Absolutely, a nimble...
full-time team, and then and then we're in this brilliant world of freelance talent.
And I think it's important with the freelance because they not everyone's suitable for every job.
Yeah.
And so you can really bring in a bespoke team, excuse the pun, but also the way of different creatives, like their whole
different
spin on it.
Different projects.
That keeps me kind of really plugged in because they're like, how about we do it this way? And as much as I love the journey with all of the talent we worked with and all of the big global brands we worked with, that was of a time where the kind of creative would be on a shoot where there were, many zeros on a check to create this aspirational make-believe world. I started to not believe in it as much about 5 years ago. I know I'm jumping ahead a bit, but I started to sort of look at, just the kind of that being part of the problem, that actually it's just about selling product and it looks really sexy and it looks really glossy and there's a big sort of face on the tin.
Yeah, I sort of think the days of big ideas, you know, it's different in this social world where you need a lot of content all the time, don't you? You know, and you can have these massive campaigns twice a year, but they actually cost a huge amount of money. They get quite tired quite quickly.
Yeah.
And actually something more authentic and more raw can actually resonate a lot better.
Yeah.
And drive sales more and but I mean, you've worked with incredible brands at Bespoke Banter, you know. I mean, you just mentioned the biggest beauty houses there in the world, so massive kudos to you.
The key to all of that was Kate Moss, and I tell her often, because we were making a lot of our business on the back of Fashion Weeks. We would do a lot of the stuff with the BFC and, you know, a lot of the sponsors, be it Mercedes and L'Oreal and Maybelline. We would sort of capture those sort of backstage in those days before people were, you know, mopping it all up on their cell phones. It was kind of us going in and having that exclusive with that designer, then going to the hairstylist, makeup artist, Val Garner, or whatever, and then doing the front row.
The sort of B-roll stuff, basically.
So just making assets for like a Mercedes showreel during Fashion Week or whatever. Yeah. And that was our bread and butter. And it was fine. It was fun. It was great. And, you know, lots of fun stories to share on that one. But it was Kate that changed what we stood for, what our DNA was. And that was because there was a Longchamp gig and they decided that alongside the stills, they really wanted her to talk. And we were the allotted team to come in, and I was the fashion correspondent to sort of do the interview. And it was one of those hilarious evenings where this sort of car had to go around sort of six times around Bond Street because there were so many paparazzi outside. And then she eventually got through this sort of tunnel that was made. So she sort of came through. Poor love sort of fell into.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
To the store, and I'm there with the mic. And thankfully, we hit it off. That evening turned the whole business around, because then Kate said to Storm at the time, can we use him for all of my interviews where they want me to speak? And so from that, it literally overnight, like, we did every kind of talky piece with Kate. So then she had her unit. She would have like Sam McKnight doing the hair and Val or Charlotte doing the makeup.
And she felt safe knowing that you were there with the mic.
She felt safe.
Yeah.
And we kind of made it a conversation rather than a press release answer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that made everyone else come in the way of, you know, Karl Lagerfeld and David Beckham and, you know, Charlotte Tilbury, obviously, and Cara Delevingne and, you know, Bella Hadid and Gigi, and like it all then came off the back of Kate. So I'm always so grateful to her for that.
Aww.
Because it changed our whole DNA.
Amazing. So they're all people that you've worked with in on a similar basis. What they're interviewing them or providing the infrastructure for them.
Yeah, doing their interviews in there, and if they're an ambassador of a brand, then we create all the digital content for them. And that would often be a kind of talent sort of exclusive. So I know Karl Lagerfeld, for example, he didn't want to do loads of media interviews. So I would go equipped with every broadsheet, every national, every consumer title, Vogue. I would have all the questions, and he would just do one exclusive with me. And then we would sort of farm it out to those various channels. So that happened a lot.
Amazing. Who's the best person you've interviewed? Give me three.
Oh, my God.
Go on. So,
I mean, Kate, obviously, just because I absolutely love the bones of that girl.
Charlotte. I told you he's friends with them all.
Oh, no, she's amazing. We just did a shoot the other day. She's absolutely amazing. Charlotte's so bombastic and charismatic and powerful. And yeah, Charlotte Tilbury, we've worked a lot together. We did an awful lot of her content when she started Tilbury. And so, yeah, I mean, just adore her. There's more sort of academic people in actors, I suppose, over the years. We did a really fun thing with Bella Hadid not too long ago, which obviously lots of your listeners know about Bella, but it was a sort of truth or dare thing, and her sort of team was sort of saying, well, I don't know, she'll probably give you like 10 minutes. Anyway, 2 hours later, we're in the bath at the Langham, or the Connaught, I think it was, just doing this whole kind of truth or dare film. So she was such fun, because what was going to be like a quick 10-minute interview turned into a two-hour film.
That's the best, though. You clearly made her feel so fabulous and at ease that she enjoyed it. And like, I think as an interviewer, that is such a great feeling, isn't it? When you feel, and that's what you hope for, I think, isn't it? That you... What do you hope you build that?
Well, you sit down at the beginning and go, look, this can go one of two ways. So we can either just sort of step through this as a press release, or we could actually leave something that actually will really help the brand, but help you as well. Yeah. And we have a lot of fun in the process. Yeah. And let's go for that one. You know, so
who wouldn't want to have fun with Scott Wimsett with a cat with a microphone? I mean, and a bath. Sounds brilliant. So, I mean, career-wise, phenomenal. What a great career story, and what amazing things you've done and continue to do.
I love it all, actually. I'm sort of at a place where sense of purpose, creatively, from self perspective, is ticking quite a lot of boxes. You know, that I get to do the directing, but I also then get to do the presenting. And then I really do enjoy the post-production, sitting on the edits from my director and my editors and stuff. So. Yeah.
We were just saying before we went on air, the sort of pressure to see
every single bit
before it goes
out.
Well,
you know, I mean, look at the growth of Sheerlux, and you have your name on all those, every single asset that comes out. It's
trying to let go of a few, but yeah, it's hard, isn't it? Can we go back to sort of time post Paul? Can we get to meeting your husband, Freddie, who is also a phenomenal talent?
Oh, yeah, muralist. Yeah, chinoiserie, and yeah, clever, clever boy.
How did you meet? Well, I know this is what you told me, but for our listeners...
Oh, God, do I do it? I'll do a quick whistle stop.
Okay.
I had been dating a guy whose sister's very famous, called Madonna. Just sort of drop that one, and that sounds really terrible. So I clashed name drop.
No, great. We're loving it.
It was a sort of really fun, sort of, you know, transatlantic kind of LA London type of thing. Again, I was saying yes to lots of stuff. It was life. I feel yes is so important. So I was having fun. And we stayed really good friends, Christopher and I. And I was going for a casting many years later in Los Angeles at Universal. And I messaged him saying, I'm going to be in LA. Can I stay at the flat? Yes, of course. Day before, he phones and says, I'm really sorry. I'm going to be in Miami for work, but I'll send my new driver. I didn't give it a second thought. Had a birthday party the night before in Somerset. So I kind of get to LAX, slightly not slept that well. Thought I would just sort of try to have a sort of little, a sort of hairy dog. Well, I sort of had a gin and tonic on the flight, and then it was sort of made me feel even worse. So I kind of got off the plane looking a little bit like Ken Dodd. I was sort of one eyeball over here and just not looking my best. And then Freddie was standing, and I'd been single for like 6-7 years. Freddie was standing under a skylight with the sun shining down on him in these sawn-off denims with my name, Scott Wimsett, on a card. It was love at first sight. I fell in love at that moment, knowing it was gigantic. And I don't know how and why, what happened there to make that so gigantic and significant. But I knew that we had a history, a story together moving forward. It was just plain as day. I just knew.
Wow. Oh, that really made me... Gave me the butterflies. So he picked you up.
Oh, yes.
Okay, well, we'll squirt through what happened.
In a Mustang.
Yeah. Right.
He was a terrible driver, by the way. And in those days, I was smoking fags. So I couldn't look at him, and I was sort of smoking out the window, just so nervous, just thinking, if this is what I think it is, then...
I'm going to die thinking that I've met the love of my life. He might be terrible. He might kill me with his driving.
Yes.
I'm going to die with a cigarette.
Appalling driving, yeah.
So he was obviously based in LA.
Yeah.
You've flown over... How did you two end up back here together, married?
In that time in LA, there was all sorts of certain things happened, and Christopher got quite unwell and ended up in hospital. And so we were both sort of tending the sort of hospital trips, and Freddie would turn up in sort of drag occasionally to cheer Christopher up. So he'd have these like nurse's outfits on with sort of thigh-high boots up to here full of balloons. And I'd be like, wow, you're definitely somebody I want to spend the rest of my life with. You're brilliant fun. It was just this sort of, you know, big, lovely love story in the space of 3 weeks. And then I sort of left because he had a boyfriend at the time, but they were very unhappy. Aww. And nothing had happened and all that kind of stuff. It was all pretty well behaved. And I left, and I came back about 6 months later, knocked on his door and did a whole kind of sort of Hugh Grant kind of talk about how much I'd fallen in love with him and I wanted to spend the rest of my life with him. And he agreed to come back to London. And that was it. I knew he was single at that point. So.
So he came back to London.
He came back to London.
When did you get married?
We got married about 2.5 years after that. Okay. We had 3 weddings, which is very greedy of us. One for my mother, the illegal one in the UK. And then we were going to have our proper wedding in Los Angeles, where all our sort of pals would come in Ojai. And then our Somerset friends said, look, a lot of us are on farms with tons of kids. We can't all get to LA, so why don't we do another wedding for you? So it was ridiculous.
Oh, right? Okay then.
3 weddings, which I do apologise for those who came to all 3, but thank you for coming.
I'm sure they were delighted. I bet they were great fun. You say the illegal one in the UK, that's because marriage,
yes,
same-sex marriage hadn't been legalised here.
No, it had been legalised here, but Freddie had to stay in the country. I was an American citizen, so I had to sort of marry him sharpish so that he didn't have to hoik it back to LA.
Oh, I see.
Did a very moderate kind of family gathering in the garden, and then we did the mariage, and then we had the big wedding in LA.
I'd like to see pictures.
Yes.
What did you wear?
Freddie made our outfits. He's good. Be careful that one. He grew up on a farm in Minnesota from a family that had this real can-do attitude. They did everything themselves. So very different childhood to me. You know, he would.
Is he American?
Yeah. So he could fix the car, he could make a dress, he can paint the walls, he could, you know, he's incredibly
useful,
can do about stuff. So he made our wedding outfits, which were lovely. Oh, I'll send them to you.
I'd love to see. And you lived in London for a while?
Yep, all the time. Yep, we were living in London.
And you're now based in Somerset?
Mostly Somerset and Portugal.
And you have a son who you adopted?
Yes.
And can you tell us about the process, knowing you were going to do it, why you chose that route?
Yeah, I don't want to be contentious about it. I guess from a gay man's perspective, I do feel that there are certain duties in the way of parenthood, and that there are an awful lot of children that need a home. So as much as I have gay friends that have gone down the surrogacy route, again, I'm not coming from a place of judgment. My own personal decision was to adopt. And it comes with all of its complexities, as you can imagine, because invariably they have come from trauma. So that was very sort of true of our son's case. You know, he arrived with a whole bag of worries, I guess, as a little boy.
At what age?
He was 4. So he'd had quite a long time in a chaotic setup. You know, Freddie and I were with an amazing agency called Family Futures, who we still privately raise money for because they are the Aston Martin of the adoption world. They're absolutely incredible. And I'm not entirely sure we could have got to where we have in the way of all of us feeling so safe if we didn't have them. They are literally at the end of the phone all the time you need them, and we really did need them in the early days.
How long was the process?
So 2 years from beginning to end, but they, with Family Futures, they really build you up. So they really get you prepped and ready. It's quite an interesting process. We'd quite often come back from the sessions, Freddie and I, and open a bottle of wine and go, God, I didn't know that about your childhood. Or, you know, there were fascinating things that we found out about each other that really equipped us for parenting and knowing our skill sets sort of independently. You know, the process of meeting your child is again, fascinating, because our son was supposed to be going to another family. I thought he was ours all along, but at the last hurdle, they said, I'm really sorry, we're sending him to another family. And I was having breakfast with Alice at Chateau Marmont. I remember it vividly. And the phone rang, and it was Freddie. And he said, everything's changed. He is our son, and he arrives in 2 weeks. You know, when your gut instinct had told you that that was going to be our reality. Yeah, so within a week, we were kind of camping out at his foster family's house and in around the corner in a B&B. And each day, they would sort of slowly introduce us more, that we'd go and spend a bit more time with him. So eventually, you kind of not just sort of waking up in the morning and seeing him at breakfast, you'd sort of do story time and bath time. You know, you would take him out for a picnic. And so one day, they said, just be really speedy about it. Just sort of one morning, just came in, did the paperwork, popped him in the car and came back to Camden and started our life together. And I remember, I'll never forget looking into the garden. We'd only been there 2 hours, and the two of them, Freddie and our son, were gardening together, and I was cooking lunch, and just thought, here's our life, here it is.
Wow, wow.
And now, you know, he is living in Somerset and having the time of his life and thriving, and he's 11 and he's a happy, gorgeous, well-adjusted little boy. Just dyed his hair, bleached all his hair peroxide. Got 2 dads that are pretty up for saying yes.
And how does he feel about having 2 dads?
Oh, he's made up. He loves it. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm more mummy. I think he does think I'm more mummy than daddy. So I'm Pops. Freddie's daddy. I'm Pops. I was going to be Papa, and I thought, oh, no, that's far too camp. I'll be Pops. So I've gone with Pops.
I think that's perfect.
I'll grow into it, I suppose. It does feel a bit granddad.
Do you feel like you can just be you. Do you feel totally at ease? I feel like you do. I feel like totally. You just own it.
And
you...
My mother's sister died very young, and so her two children came to us. So from three kids, we went to five in quite a short sort of period of time. And so I just sort of love the chaos of life and the busyness. I'm very used to that. That's sort of my modus operandi. It's how I grew up. Busy table, trying to vie for attention, you know. So a child who's
so
kind
many
of
the best people did, I have to say.
But do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you know,
I've interviewed many people and... who've said the same, and you're always like, oh, that sounds fabulous. And they are fabulous as a result.
But I think, you know, our son, you know, he there were complications at the beginning, and I wouldn't forever sort of suggest it was easy, but there was a huge permission for humour. And there was also a lot of time in, and we were, you know, from a gay perspective, I suppose, Freddie and I were empaths. We were really willing to sit down and have that big, let's have a conversation about how you feel. So it was never about sort of copying traditional parenting that would have been slightly Victorian from our families growing up. It actually was very sort of therapy led. And so everything that we would suggest that for our son would be a good idea, it was never, you're just doing this, you know, don't speak back type thing. It was like, the reasons why, darling, is big. And we always end with, it's because I want you to be safe. And I love you so much. And we say all of that all the time. I still do. Every night I go into his room and when he's fast asleep and before I go to bed, just sort of whisper in his ear, I love you. It goes through somehow. It sort of, he feels very safe.
I would say to my daughter, you know, I love you so much. She said, Mommy, I know, you tell me all the time. You and Daddy
just
tell
don't
me
forget.
All the time. I was like, but I do.
How many babies do you have? You can't underestimate three, but...
Can't underestimate how important that is.
You're amazing. To run your business and have three babies.
Don't. It's all
I'm
chaos.
I love strong women.
It's all chaos. And do you have advice for other people? You know, if there are other gay men, women listening who want to go down the road of adoption, is there advice that you have? I mean, I imagine you just took it all in your stride. And
look, I mean, I think parenthood anyway comes with a whole load of complications. It's never a sort of straightforward thing. It's not a linear line. Yeah. You know, it's you know that one. It's and all the ages present different sort of narratives, and it's making sure that you have a lot of fun with it. Advice would be, it's not for everybody. I think Freddie and I had to really make sure that we were solid enough to do it, because it, again, and he wouldn't mind me saying, it was full on for us at the beginning because we had a son with a lot of needs. Mm. But gosh, we're a unit. We're so super tight, the three of us. It's a very powerful thing.
That gives me all the feels. It seems like you deserve every minute of that. Can you tell me a bit about building your own brand? Have you consciously done this, or are you just like gay extra and a yes man in the
I
best?
No, I work with talent, so I'm sort of they're the talent, and I'm just sort of that reporter, a correspondent, a sort of trusted advisor, an investigative.
But aren't the best reporters, correspondents, presenters? Aren't they also? Don't they bring their own?
I think
razzle dazzle.
I think it was very much about trust, because obviously when you're dealing with the profile of some of our clients, it was about making sure that everything lined up, that the digital click play assets that we create or the stills on the back of campaigns or whatever, that they really firmly trust that you've got their best interests and the brand's best interests. Mm. And it's not quickly earned.
It takes time.
It's a long time.
Yeah, I'm sure you've grafted hard. In fact, I know people say you work incredibly hard, and you know, that counts for
do
a lot.
Do they? Oh, that's very sweet. But I've also, you know, it's about the kind of, you know, what does success look like? I feel like there's so long ahead. There's so much to do still. I don't feel at any point, oh, I've made it. And, you know, I don't feel like that. The only thing I feel does look like success, because money will follow and that's all secondary. It's about getting the trust and the respect from your fellow people that you work with. That to me is
and that's
the most important thing.
That is such good life advice. I really believe that. Yeah, I think that's great. Can we talk a bit about fashion and style? And I'm used to seeing you in a suit.
I know.
At Ascot, looking very
sorry,
smart.
I'm just a bit.
And here you are, looking
like
very Somerset and wonderful.
I know.
And you've taken off your brilliant coat.
My Oxfam coat from Bay Garnet,
which I love because she was here this week and was a massive hit.
Yes, love Bay.
But tell me about your own personal style and how you've created that. Has it just happened.
Do you know, it's changed so much over the years. Because as a fashion correspondent, obviously you kind of feel like you need to not neglect that side of things. And, you know, very fortunate over the years, you know, if you're doing an event for a certain brand and they dress you. And so, you know, with time, I've always been a thrifter. So I've always loved sort of diving in. If I'm in New York or LA, brilliant sort of secondhand shopping there, pre-loved. I had a funny old gig many years ago. I want to say 2009, for about 4 years, alongside Bespoke, I was doing something called the Scott Report, which was Hello's magazine's online international fashion correspondent. Mm. Now, that kind of just gave me a bit of an option to do like some events in the week. So whether it was the Serpentine Gallery summer party or some sort of red carpet, or I would be in New York Fashion Week or, you know, whatever it was. And so that kept me really visible. And it also really makes you kind of think carefully about what you're wearing all the time, because you're constantly on camera and you're constantly sort of out and about and not wanting to repeat it too much. In those days, you didn't repeat it too much. Now, obviously, it's applauded and I love that. But in those days, you didn't wear the same thing you wore last week on another thing. So I don't have a particular style. I think when anyone goes into my wardrobe, there are so many different characters playing out and it depends how I feel on the day.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a lot of Moroccan clothes, a lot of Indian clothes, a lot of Savile Row, a lot of proper Somerset hippie stuff, Glastonbury. You know, it's all shapes and sizes. It depends how I feel and where I am in the world, I suppose.
And advice to other men when it comes to style? I mean, it's a sort of cliche question, but are there some sort of general style tips that you live by?
It's really boring. I mean, one of my things I think for everybody, men and women, and they and everybody, is to really look after yourself health-wise. Because how you feel and wear clothes when you actually have a bit of a healthy bod underneath is absolutely the sort of backbone to style, I think. It's how you hold yourself. It's how you the clothes fall on you. I think given the time, I mean, I swim a lot. I run a fair amount. I'm a skinny blinks anyway, but it's just, I think it's, I really notice it with models that I've worked with, just looking after your body, then style will follow. Mm. My granny always used to say, look in the mirror before you go out and remove something.
Mm.
Don't keep it too busy. And I think that's a good one.
Occasionally, I want to be a Christmas tree and put everything off.
But
I mean, your granny is right. And what about grooming wise?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I use a lot stuff. I'm sorry. I mean, I suppose I've always been a beauty junkie, and being in the gig that I'm in and the clients that I have, and then I work with I'm on the advisory board for the British Beauty Council. You know, we get a lot of stuff. I love products, but I've definitely been going much more down the sort of, you know, ethical, green, natural skincare route in the back of my values for sustainability. And we've started something called the Sustainable Task Force on the Sustainable Beauty Coalition, which is an arm of the Beauty Council. So it's a sort of team of industry people who are working with brands to help them realise their sort of green targets. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of definitely something that's happened with Bespoke, because we started the Feel Good Fellowship, which is an arm of Bespoke that I did with Arizona Muse, who's a model and activist and good friend. We started it together and we sort of went to
lots of
brands to get them to speak openly, removing the fourth wall and being a little bit more transparent about what their business is all about, which in those days, you know, it was complex for a lot of them.
Well, we've come a long way, haven't we?
And now we're in a different place, yeah. So it's sort of very much the kind of work we're doing now, working with brands and exploring their B Corp, doing documentary. Arizona's no longer with Feel Good Fellowship. She started Dirt and she's doing her own thing, but we started it together and then I carried it on.
And this all comes under the
umbrella of Bespoke.
Of Bespoke.
Yeah.
Amazing. Phenomenal. What are you not into? You're moving and shaking in all the right places, all the right people. It's a total joy to have you on our podcast.
Oh, darling,
Thank you so much. Come again soon. I'm very sad to say that's it for today. If you enjoyed that, then do please rate, review, leave a comment, tell your friends to listen to, and we will be back soon. Thank you,
darling.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.